to get down and work at it and try material. So one day, quite by accident, I bought an old book in a bookshop called Building Eras in Religion by Horace Bushnell. And to my utter surprise, as I read this book, I found any number of essays that related to preaching. And not only did I find this, but I found this man to have some enormously valuable insights about preaching. So I speedily concluded that this was a person who certainly ought to come within the purview of this course. Now, actually, Bushnell represents one of the most pivotal figures in American theology. In a real sense, he represents what you might call the later or the modern development of American religious thought, just as Jonathan Edwards would represent the earlier. In fact, I would say that Edwards and Bushnell are the pivots upon whom so much of our intellectual history has turned. Now, Bushnell was born on April 14, 1802, in Litchfield County, Connecticut. His father and mother were people of the soil, basically. They had a common school education, but they were plain farming people. His ancestors had remained for 8 generations in the same locality. Bushnell remained at home until he was 21 years of age, and he attended the village schools. In fact, all of his early life was that of life on a New England farm. So far as we can tell, he had a very happy boyhood, and he carried through life a never-failing love of nature, habits of close observation, and a keen and persistent interest in engineering and mechanics. I guess you would say he came out of an ecumenical household in that his father was a Methodist, his mother was a Congregationalist, or rather an Episcopalian, and then the whole family joined the local Congregational church where they were active workers. Now, we're told that Bushnell was dutifully reared on the Westminster Shorter Catechism. He listened somewhat respectfully, although probably impatiently, along with his parents, to rigidly Calvinistic sermons on free will, fixed fate, foreknowledge, redemption, special grace, and eternity. He tells us that there were more than one occasion. There was more than one occasion when his father would come home from church to a rather late dinner, and he would let loose the anger of his irritation about the preacher's sermon for the day on tough predestinationism or depravity or what have you. Bushnell had what I think is a priceless bestowal in the life of any person, namely, he lived in a home that greatly favored independent thought. Recalling his own boyhood experience later, he said, "No hamper was placed on our liberty of thought and choice. We were allowed to have our own questions, and no particular scruples were forced upon us. Only," he said, "it was given us a caution that truth is the best thing in the world, and nobody can afford to part with it even for an hour." Well, it seems that Bushnell grew up as a kind of happy-go-lucky type person. He was good-natured, vigorous, fond of outdoor sports. But he was also a very serious and perhaps even over-thoughtful person. At the age of 19, he united with the Congregational Church of his boyhood. And for a while, he seems to have shared enthusiastically in its religious activity. Well, in 1823, when he was 21 years of age, he entered Yale University, and obviously he was older and more mature than the average student, and he was also rather homespun in manner and dress. His intellectual life in the university was marked by earnestness and a growing consciousness of power. He also demonstrated early the same independence of thought that he so fiercely demonstrated later. He thought for himself. He thought vigorously. But while his moral earnestness remained, he said that his religious convictions began to fade. Years later, his daughter, Mary Bushnell Cheney, wrote his life story, and she said, "A year or two before entering college, while still under the influences of home, he had accepted, rather than thought out, the faith of his youth. Now, for the first time, the great untried world of thought opened before him, and his mind launched out on a sea of doubt." Well, after graduation from Yale, his plans remained unsettled. We are told that he taught school for a few months, but he found his occupation uncongenial, and so he abandoned that. And then for just a short while, he was a journalist for the Journal of Commerce in New York City, but he found this an utterly terrible life. So before the year was out, he resigned his position to enter the law school at Yale. But then again, after 6 months, he left the university. And while he was groping for his real vocation, it seems that his religious difficulties began to mount. He soon discovered that given all his doubts and his religious perplexities, he could not enter upon the preparation of theology as his mother had hoped for him. He wrote in his journal, "A year after graduation, when my bills were paid," now you all can all identify with that, "and when the question was what was to be decided, whether I should begin the preparation of theology, I was thrown," he said, "upon a most painful struggle by the very evident and quite incontestable fact that my religious life had utterly gone down. And the pain it caused was miserably enhanced by the disappointment that I brought to my mother by withdrawing from the ministry." He said, "I had run no dissipations. I had been a thoughtful, church-going person. My very difficulty," said Bushnell, "was that I was too thoughtful, substituting thought for everything else, expecting so intently to dig out a religion by my head that I was pushing it all the while practically away. And finally," he said, "my spiritual life required many turns of loss and recovery to ripen it." Now, I want to say just a word here, and I cannot help but feel that many years after those words were written, when he stood in the Battelle Chapel at Yale to preach a sermon which was later published called The Dissolving of Doubts, I really feel that this was a highly autobiographical sermon. I went back and read this sermon, and in that sermon, Bushnell said, "Is there no truth that I do believe? Yes, there is one, the distinction between right and wrong, that I never doubted. Then," he said, "the question comes, have I ever taken the principle of right for my law? Have I ever thrown my life on that principle to become all that it requires of me? No," he said, "I have not. Then here is something for me to do." And then as you read into that, read further in that sermon, Bushnell gives this piece of advice. He says, "Never be in a hurry to believe. Never try to conquer your doubts against time. Time is one of the grand elements of thought as it is in motion." Bushnell said, "If you cannot open a doubt today, keep it until tomorrow. Do not be afraid to keep it for a whole year. One of the greatest talents in religious discovery," said Bushnell, "is learning how to hang up questions and let them hang without being at all anxious about them." You know, this whole business of doubt is, I think, in itself a very interesting thing. And I can, identify quite meaningfully with what Bushnell is talking about here. I think we can all admit that some doubts, after all, are wrong because they are not honestly acquired. My own experience with doubt, of whatever nature it might be, leads me to believe that this is one of those areas where one needs to be scrupulously demanding of himself. Out of what has this doubt come? From what has it originated? Has this doubt been honestly acquired? And let's go on and be further honest and recognize that some doubts actually are the scum of unworthy conduct. I think also there is such a thing as a doubt that is mere intellectual conceit. We raise questions about religion, but we're not at all deeply serious. No doubt that you've had people in your churches who are very eager to debate with you about matters of religion or raise some question, but one feels almost when you deal with them that they're coming at religion very much as a kind of dilettante. Here's something to sort of play with, as it were. And yet there's no underlying moral earnestness about the resolving of their doubt. Now, having said that, I must confess that I have a good deal of problems with people who say that they never honestly had a doubt. I'm partly irritated simply because I wish I could be in that category. And I guess I resent those who can have such a marvelous resolution of doubt. If you've never had a doubt, I think the question I would simply raise, do you really have a faith that's worth calling a faith? I think that's the way I would be inclined to put it. In other words, if faith has no odds to meet, would it not be rather scant virtue after all? And I think here, when we look back upon what Bushnell has to say, at least my experience would confirm his observation here. I think there are times in life when we simply have to get on with the business of living, whatever the religious problems might be. For example, I get the impression from the New Testament, and I'm certainly no New Testament scholar, we all know that, but I get the impression that Paul, in a real sense, was a man who had a great many unanswered questions. Now, I know in some of his writings, you get this overwhelming note of certainty. But I think also he lived and died a troubled man. If for nothing else, he's bound to have been troubled about what he called his thorn in the flesh. But I think the amazing fact in his life is that he learned that you can get on with the business of living, thorn in the flesh or not. Now, somewhere down the way, I really fear that we all have to deal with ourselves rather strenuously sometimes on these issues. To be sure, our faith is always a greater thing than we can grasp, if all you can proclaim in the pulpit is simply your own measure of the faith, we wouldn't have much to proclaim. There's always something here that breaks through language and escapes. It's always bigger than any one of us. We're always dealing with the realities that are far beyond our scope. But somewhere in all this, I think we really have to get down and deal with ourselves. When I read about Bushnell and his experience, I think of those words of Tennyson in his poem, In Memoriam. He was thinking back of his great friend, Arthur Hallam, whom that poem commemorates. And he says, perplexed in faith, but pure in deeds, at last he beat his music out. There lives more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds. He fought his doubts and gathered strength. He would not make his judgments blind. He faced the specters of the mind and laid them. Thus he came at length to find a stronger faith, his own. Well, to me, it is certainly refreshing, and it's also reassuring to know that a person who later became such an eminent religious leader in this country, that perhaps in a real sense all his days, he fought intellectually with some dimensions of the faith. Now, I think at this particular juncture in his life, partial relief came to Bushnell from a book. Have you noticed how many of the people we've dealt with in here, some of the turning point in their life came with the reading of a book? Well, this was true also of Horace Bushnell. Partial relief came to him from prolonged meditation on one of the most influential books of his day, Coleridge's Aids to Reflection. Emerson said that in 1842, that book was selling by the Shell School in New England. Apparently, it was a book that had a great deal of influence upon its readers. And at the time that this book was read by Horace Bushnell, New England had looked upon religious truth as capable of intellectual demonstration with the logical sharpness of a problem in geometry. In other words, its fundamental appeal was to the rational understanding, but Coleridge, in Age to Reflection, broke with that conception. To him, Christianity is primarily graspable by intuition. Its appeal is not so much to the intellect as to ethical and spiritual feeling. Here again, we get this rhetoric of sensation versus the rhetoric of the intellect. Now, for Coleridge, religion begins and ends with the heart. In fact, in Coleridge's Age to Reflection, he wrote, "Too soon did the doctors of the church forget that the heart, the moral nature, was the beginning and the end, and that truth, knowledge, and insight were comprehended in its expansion." He said this was the first and the true apostasy when, in council and in synod, the divine humanities of the gospel gave way to speculative systems and religion became a science of shadows under the name of theology. In Coleridge's Age to Reflection, Bushnell found, again, the one book that influenced him more than any other apart from the Bible. Gradually, he came to greater religious certainty and to the conviction that the whole system of dependence on intellectual demonstration that was characteristic of the explanation of religion in that day was mistaken. Bushnell said religion appeals primarily to the heart and to the feeling for its compelling demonstration. And we'll say a little bit more about this later on. Now, his intellectual doubts continued for some time, to be sure, but he came increasingly to rely upon feeling and moral intuition and observation and experience. These were more significant to him than mere cold intellectual reasoning and logic, although he was a superb logician. He was a man of great capacities of mind. You know, I always feel much better about a man's disparagement of reason when I see that he's an indefatigable reasoner. I get very worried about those who disparage reason when I don't see very much evidence of it in them. And so here, in the case of Bushnell, you've got that happy combination of a probing intellectual astuteness, but at the same time, with a proper appreciation or feeling. Now, when he came to take his theological training, here again, Bushnell went back to Yale, and at that time, one of the prominent members of the Yale faculty was Nathaniel W. Taylor. He had the very imposing title, Dwight Professor of Didactic Theology. Well, he was a very eminent person in that day and time. He was at the height of his influence. Supposedly, he felt called upon to be an exponent of the thought of Jonathan Edwards, and he was eager to improve and defend Calvinism against all foes. Now, Bushnell, when he came under the influence of Nathaniel Taylor, he was inwardly fortified and impressed by Taylor's sincerity, his courage, his independence of thought, but he found little satisfaction in the main tenets of his theology. He grew increasingly distasteful and distrustful of Dr. Taylor's attempt to establish theology simply as an intellectually demonstrable system. Even as a student, Bushnell said he found this whole approach to be too artificial, too remote from life. It was too abhorrent to the moral sense. It's rather interesting, in Taylor's language, he spoke of Bushnell, and he said, "I found in this young man one who was always on t'other side." Well, he didn't quite know what to do with this strange fledgling of his intellectual or theological myth. But Coleridge's work had already convinced Bushnell of what he called a whole new world overhead, a range of realities on a higher tier. Now, maybe the gospel was already appearing to him, actually, in terms of what he later described as a gift to the imagination. And therefore, he was naturally disposed to rely more and more upon a religious intuition than upon conventional modes of theological inquiry. Well, now the year 1833 was crucial in his life because then, in that year, he became the minister of North Church in Hartford, Connecticut. He stayed in this parish for 26 years. This was the only church he ever had. And he stayed there until ill health forced his retirement. But he took this church, and please remember, I know we all have studied about Bushnell in religious education, his theory of Christian nurture and all this, but while he became widely known as a theologian, and he is an eminent American theologian, his whole life was in the pastorate, his whole professional life. So for 26 years, he was minister of North Church in Hartford. In Barbara Cross's book, Horace Bushnell, Minister to a Changing America, she tells you some interesting things about that congregation. She entitled the chapter, A Fastidious People, and apparently they were. Before Bushnell got there, already for some 20 years or more, they had listened to Emerson and Mark Hopkins and Horace Greeley and Henry Ward Beecher and some of the other eminent divines of that period. So they were already very astute sermon tasters by the time Bushnell got there. Apparently this was a very sedate kind of congregation. In one of his sermons, Bushnell, and he was noted always for fact, in one of his sermons he said to them, "You are so walled up by respectability that the other side is an unknown world." And he also told them, "You have the power of contributors and patrons, but not of witnesses." Have you ever seen a congregation like that? Well, apparently they were consciously proper. They were described in this way. They were wary of any kind of religious extravagance. They did not believe in such a thing as a drastic change of the heart. They viewed the doctrine of depravity as unjust and extravagant. They had a certain pride that walled them in against any notion of salvation by grace. So there are various ways by which that congregation was described, but apparently they were very sedate in many ways. Now, when Bushnell came to assume the leadership of this church, he found it torn inwardly by a party spirit that was then disturbing a good many of the congregational churches in Connecticut. When he had been there 20 years, and you know when you've been up to a church for 20 years, when you've been there that long, you can afford to say a few things to the people, I guess. But in his 20th anniversary sermon, he told them that when he came there, he felt himself daintily inserted between an alkali and an acid, with his job being that of keeping himself from being bitten by one and devoured by the other. Now, if you've never had that glorious fortune of taking on a divided church, you don't know what he's talking about. But I had one congregation that certainly would personify what he said, and I know full well what it is to be daintily inserted between an alkali and an acid. Now, actually, one of the struggles that he encountered when he came there, part of the problem in that church and in New England at large, had to do with revivalism. Now, frankly, in my judgment, I think Horace Bushnell has given us some of the most perceptive criticisms of the revival system that one could find anywhere. And I want to share a little bit of that with you today. Now, actually, when Bushnell came to this church, in fact, the year before he got there, they had had a good many additions to the membership. And then over a period of time, this had declined. Now, Bushnell actually, by his very approach to the whole thing, had some real problems with revivalism as the key to church membership. In fact, he preached a sermon on the kingdom of heaven as a grain of mustard seed, in which he promulgated the idea that Christian growth ought to replace revivalistic conversions. Now, let me see if I can give you something of what he said about the matter of revival. Frankly, I think a lot of what he said is still pertinent today. Now, let me say, first of all, he did not want to abolish revivals altogether. He recognized that they could occupy a very constructive role in the life of the church. But as Bushnell saw it, he said there are four distinctive problems and cardinal defects with the revival system. First of all, he questioned the whole notion, the assumption, that the church has to be in a constant, tense state of revival. He questioned that. And then secondly, he questioned the assumption that nothing of spiritual significance could be accomplished without what he called this artificial firework, this jump and stir, as he called it. So he questioned the notion that, after all, nothing really takes place in the life of a church unless you have this artificial firework, as he called it. He also questioned the assumption that the chief thing is to convert people, not to nurture them in the Christian life. Now, this is an old story, as we all know. And then, fourthly, he questioned that the main business at the close of the revival was simply to prepare for yet another revival. Now, you know, I can tune in with this because I grew up in churches where often this was true. Let me repeat these, if some of you want to write this down. First of all, he questioned the assumption that the church has to be in a constant state of revival. Secondly, the assumption that nothing of spiritual significance is accomplished without this artificial firework. Thirdly, the assumption that the chief thing is to convert people, not to nurture them in the Christian life. And fourthly, that the main business at the close of a revival was to prepare for yet another revival. Now, if you read his sermon on the kingdom of heaven as a grain of mustard seed, you will see how that he spells this out. Now, Bushnell went on to say that the defect in the revival system, as it operated in his time, is that it has cast a type of religious individualism intense beyond any former example. Now, I think this is a very astute observation on his part. In other words, he said the problem with this is that so often it does not make enough of the organic nature of the religious life. It makes nothing of the family, or of the church, or of the organic powers God has constituted as vehicles of grace. It takes every person as though he existed alone, and presumes that he is unreconciled to God until he has undergone some kind of sudden and explosive experience in his later years. Well, when he came to preach his 20th anniversary sermon in 1853, and that's a very significant sermon because he was looking back over his years with the congregation. He said in that sermon, "The only difficulty I ever encountered in my ministry that caused me a real and deep trial of feeling related to the matter of evangelist preachers and what may be called the machinery system of revival. Things had come to such a pitch in the churches by the intensity of the revival system," said Bushnell, "that the permanent was sacrificed to the casual. The ordinary swallowed up and lost in the extraordinary, and Christian piety reduced to a kind of campaigning or stage effect exercise." And then he went on to say this: "The spirit of the pastor was broken. It was becoming a fixed impression that effect is to be looked for only under instrumentalities that are extraordinary. He," meaning the pastor, "was coming to be scarcely more than a church clock for beating time and marking the years while the effective ministry of the word was to be dispensed by a class of professional revivalists." Now, in my judgment, his observations still constitute what I would regard as some of the most trenchant criticisms of the revival system, where this is looked upon as the chief, if not the only, way to bring people into the church. Well, when he came into this congregation that was divided, Bushnell said that he immediately sensed that one side was asking himself, well, on what side will he come down? Well, Bushnell surprised the whole congregation by preaching both sides, and he said not because he wanted a false peace in his congregation. And believe me, if you know anything about Bushnell, it certainly wasn't because he was afraid of his convictions. He was a pugilist of the first order, and therefore he certainly was not afraid of serving a controversy. But he said he preached both sides in this whole Edwardian conflict between what was then called the liberal and the conservative Edwardians. He preached both sides, he said, because he was passing into what he called the comprehensive method of settling theological differences. And he tells us in his essay on Christian comprehensiveness what he means by this. He said, in the comprehensive school of thought, it will be a first conviction that all serious, earnest persons have something in their view which makes truth real to them. Therefore, that all serious and earnest people, however repugnant in their words, will have some area of radical agreement, and if the place can be found, will somewhere reveal their brotherhood. Therefore, they're not only to tolerate, but to love and respect each other. They are to ask each what has the other that is necessary for my own completeness in the truth. Well, in his anniversary sermon, Bushnell said that the effect of his ministry was not to overthrow one school and set up another, rather to comprehend, if possible, the truth contended for in both. Well, in that sermon on Christian comprehensiveness, he appealed to Jesus as the example of what he was talking about. He said that, after all, our Lord held his equilibrium. He flew into no eccentricities. He saved what was valuable and what he destroyed. He destroyed nothing where it was more desirable rather to fulfill than to destroy. Now, he went on to say, take, for example, the Calvinist view of election. He said, after all, those who seem to despise this viewpoint so much, he said, if they will suspend their judgment long enough to sound its depths, they will discover that there was something in Calvinism that gave it its peculiar moral energy. Namely, in Calvinism, God's will becomes a reality. The world is felt to be in his hands. He asks no leave to reign. Well, take the whole matter of the demand for spiritual regeneration. Bushnell said, after all, what do you have? You've got two sides, each one saying, at least part of the truth. You have one side, he said, that is eager to stress the divine agency and the spiritual dependence of a person. You have another side stressing the liberty and the responsibility of the subject. Now, says Bushnell, both sides assert our dependence, both our ability, but one a dependence which to the other destroys all ability, and the other an ability that sets out to destroy all dependence. So, he says, if we will not be in haste to enroll ourselves as disciples or partisans and ascend to a higher position, this is what we might see. We might find a soul, he said, under the bondage of evil that is able to renew itself in good and through dependence, able to work because God works in that person. It will not be said, said Bushnell, that this person has a natural ability that means nothing, nor a natural ability that means that he can do it all by himself. Well, he goes on to say in that particular essay, it's the same old question perpetually recurring in matters of religion. We have the bigot on one side asserting that nothing can be new, and the radical on the other that nothing shall be old. Well, you see, that's been around too for a long time. I'm reminded of what E. Stanley Jones once said, if all people in the world were liberal, the world would blow up. If we were all conservative, the world would dry up. And I think there's a great deal of insight in that. Well, Bushnell actually hoped that his comprehensive method would be one way of overcoming sectarianism. Now, he did not regard the rise of denominations as necessarily an evil. In fact, he said each one stands for a truth that might not otherwise have gained recognition, and yet he viewed the perpetuation of denominations as the evidence that Christianity was still in a crude state. Now, I think it ought to be said, however, that America was not quite ready for Bushnell's Catholicity, and paradoxically, this good man who did so much to advocate this comprehensive method in achieving Christian fellowship was himself destined to be the center, the storm center of a great deal of religious conflict. Now, no consideration of Bushnell's ideas on preaching would be adequate without mentioning his theory of language. Remember, he lived in a time when, by and large, the great thinkers were solitary people. They sort of dwelt alone and aloof, as it were. They sat in ivory towers of speculation, They concocted elaborate systems of theology and what have you. And they viewed the strength of a theological system in terms of its definition and logic. The pupils of the students of Nathaniel W. Taylor remembered nothing quite so well as his fervent stress on the whole business of making definitions, which he regarded as the severest labor of the human mind. Now, Bushnell saw the flaw in this. He says the problem with this is that when you define what you mean, there is always something that breaks through language and escapes. There's something that lies outside these narrow boundaries of definition that would call for redefinition. So an endless process is established, said Bushnell, primarily because we are trying to embrace the infinite within the finite. Now, Bushnell said that the greater part of the labors of theology lie outside the boundaries of mere definition. He said we ought to break up and advance beyond this hard literalism. Well, he had his, he wrote an essay called Our Gospel, A Gift to the Imagination. And what he's really appealing for, if I understand it, is simply that we recover the evocative, symbolic power of language. He was moving away from the notion that here in precise definition, the formalities of language, one could actually nail down theological truth, as it were. Bushnell said the gospel offers itself first of all and principally to the interpretive imaginings and discernings of faith, never save in that manner to the constructive processes of logic and speculative opinion. He said when Jesus came into the world, great images were evoked which the world had not heard of before. Christ was called a door to be entered, bread from heaven to be fed upon, the water of life to quench the thirst, the life, the way, the shepherd, the healer, the teacher, the master. Now, Bushnell said that by language here, he did not mean what he called high wrought metaphorical draperies of ornamental display. But he said, I mean the power that distinguishes truths in their images and seizes hold of the images for the expression of truth. It is to take the poetic sense of figures and images. Well, no wonder he experienced difficulty. One day he was going to the Harper Association and he ran into a friend of his, a Dr. Patton. And Patton said to Bushnell, why is it that you're always misunderstood? When you're criticized, you say the critics misunderstand you, and they say you can't express yourself so that they can understand what you mean. Why can't you say it like you mean it? Bushnell said, concerning that conflict, it's because of the different views that they and I take of the human soul. They succeed, he said, in expressing their ideas as to be understood by their readers, but they deal with their subjects mechanically and not according to nature. He said, take my assailant, Dr. So-and-so. He writes about the human spirit as though it were a machine under the laws of mechanics. So naturally what he says is perfectly intelligible like any other treatise on matter, only what he says is not true. But he said, I conceive the soul in its living nature as free and intelligent and sensitive, as under vital and mechanical law, and language for that reason, he said, is not so much descriptive as it is suggestive. Now, I don't think we ought to read into this any notion that Bushnell abjured theology as a science because he refused to be bound by tradition or by definition. Nor is he concerned here to slight reason or to set aside the forms of logic. But actually here he is simply refusing to put infinite things into finite forms as wholly containing them. You know, when we come to study the modernist fundamentalist controversy in the 20s, this is precisely what you will see. The whole struggle between the matter of very precise doctrinal orthodoxy on the one hand and the people like Fosdick on the other, to recognize that when you've said your best about theology, it's always subject to the push and pull of changing circumstances. Now, actually, let me say this to you. The best part of this lecture is the one that's coming on Thursday, simply because we're going to get into what Bushnell had to say about preaching as such. And at least in my judgment, he had some superb insights into preaching.